All right. Thank you very much, Lynn. And hello, everyone. And actually, I think I want to start. My first question is, how would you like me to say your name? When I see it written, I would say Suzanne, but I did listen to Rick Archer. He called you Susanna.
It's actually Susanna.
Susanna.
Okay. Yeah, my mother's German, so yeah.
All right.
Thanks for asking.
Oh, you're welcome. Susanna.
Susanna.
Susanna Marie. So thank you very much for coming. We're very, very happy to have you here. Usually when we do the interviews, we just start off with a little bit of the story of the guest so that people can get to know the guest a little bit. We don't want to spend the whole time on the story. There's other things that we're interested in. But if you could just give us a little bit of that story so people can, get to know you a little bit, that would be really nice.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to keep it brief as well.
Okay. I understand.
The story, you know, it is part and parcel, but it's also the past in a way. But it does affect who we are right now, right? Our story.
Yes.
Well, I was born in Europe, and I lived for the first 14 years, for the most part, in Europe. And I kind of had an eclectic upbringing. Went to boarding school at 9 years old. And from an early age, I was truly interested in, I wouldn't have called it spirituality, but what I would have called it was understanding the unified sense of the kind of like unity consciousness, because I had a strong sense of unity consciousness as a child, and it ebbed away between 7 and 9. It was very painful for me, and so I went on a search for that part, getting, having that part back, whatever that missing part was. And so I became a seeker at a young age, but I didn't know that that's what had happened, and I didn't really know that I was now in the search of it. But I had a sense that something very vital was ebbing away around 7 or 9, and I speak about it in my interview with Rick Archer on Buddha at the Gas Pump, and. But something remained. I wouldn't say that it completely disappeared. I wouldn't say that I got completely caught up by Maya, you know, the dream state. There was enough there to know that there was a missing of something. And so in my teens, I got interested in different spiritual things. More elemental, like things having to do with nature, feeling close to nature and such. And then when I was 19, I discovered yoga and meditation. And I felt like I was coming home when I discovered yoga and meditation, because it was the first time that I was reading texts coming in contact with people who were speaking to what it is that I felt like I was longing for, which was God consciousness and such. So I kind of went on a little bit of the, I wouldn't say I was in any way Hindu, but a bit from that path, the yogic path. And I lived in an ashram for a little while, and I met Amichi, if you know who she is.
I do.
Oh, that's 25 and in Santa Fe. And that kind of, that was a real, I felt very validated and confirmed in terms of being that there was somebody, there was a model of somebody that I really, respected and could see that she, in my,
whoops, hold on. She just froze.
Oh, did you froze?
You're back now. Yes, you froze
okay,
for a
okay,
second.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you looked really still for a minute. So, I just thought, here is a God realized being, and more than that, and just showing what's possible, all the service that's possible, and love for humanity and for the world. And so she's been a great model for me. And then I had children. I'm just going to fast forward.
That's okay.
Yeah. And I kind of thought for a good while, I kind of thought that, like God realization, which was what I thought of as unity consciousness, I felt like I was getting closer and closer to it, as if you can really get closer and closer to it. But in a way you can, in a way I think that as the veils drop and fall away, we feel more self-connected. And that's what the whole thing's about, is that for me it was a real remembering instead of a realization, kind of a realization, but for me it was more like a return and a remembering as I felt myself, the veils falling away between myself and other, myself and life, myself and the world. That got thinner and thinner. So it was just a little bit left. And I was an intense seeker. I was so hardcore. There were only two things that were important to me, and that was my children and realizing God. So I would say that my mind and my being was really dedicated to that wholeheartedly since I was really young. I went on a few twists and turns, but for the most part. And then the real falling away happened when my brother died, and I that was like 15 years ago. And I, up till that point, I was still a bit in the magical world of thinking, of having an idea of what God realization would be. There was a bit of magical thinking still going on. And because I'm kind of mystically wired, I thought it would be I go into, like, especially then, states of consciousness really easily, of really high states of consciousness. And I thought, I'm getting closer and closer to this. And when my brother died, that I just got catapulted actually into and sobered up into reality in a more empty way. What I had not really been touching on, I'd been touching on the fullness of God, but I hadn't been touching on the emptiness of God. Even though in meditation could easily go into kind of an absent place, but it wasn't really housed inside of myself. So when my brother died, it kind of like, you know, the whole table got cleared in one swoop, and all my ideas and imaginations of what this was going to be just got discarded by life, not out of choice on my part. And so then I actually kind of started going on a different track. It was life kind of directed me into a different track, although I still very much am appreciative of Amma and nothing changed there. But I started to kind of go, without knowing it, more into non-duality. You know, what we call non-duality. Advaita, but I had, you know, it's not like I was unaware of it, but it wasn't really my fascination. And suddenly I was understanding more, kind of, I picked up the book I Am That by Nisargadatta, and it was just like I found home, because it was reflecting exact, you know, my, where I was at. So I kind of lived in this emptying out place. I was being emptied out and emptied out. It wasn't just one moment. It lasted like 2-3 years. And I'm kind of a mystically wired, so there were a lot of dramatic kind of byproducts of that. But once that kind of had lived its life out through it within me, then the true, like real true unity consciousness came in. Kind of like the tide had gone out and emptiness, you know, revealed itself and revealed all that wasn't true. And then the tide came back in, and the fullness of life and the truth of reality filled me back up so that I got to, you know, just more than had really the direct experience of the fact that of the interconnection of life. And that never went away. So it's just deepened over time, what I call embodiment. Just embodying the fact that there's form and there's also the formless, and that both are, one and the same, and it's the paradox of that. Same but not same. And so that's been like for 14 years now, I've been deepening in that. And I have to say that that's been part of the work that I do with people now, because I work with people and it's kind of like a natural outcome for me, because this, my whole life has been basically dedicated and about this journey. And I can't imagine doing anything other than, you know, my kids are almost grown. And the work that I do, I feel really, you know, lucky. And I learn something every day, not only from life and not only still being emptied out here and come face to face with whatever wants to be seen, because to me it's not done, but the work that I do with others is really deepening me. So that's it. That's in brief. Hopefully that wasn't too long.
Well, that was fine for me because I watched the entire Boot at the Gas Pump interview. So I have the longer story that goes with it. What I will say is, if anybody has a question about the story as she has just told it, anything that came up for you that you want to ask, you know the way we play this game. Put your hand up if you like, and I will turn the mic over to you. Or you can type the question in the room. If you type a question in the room, keep in mind that I am actually swiping back and forth between you and Susanna. Hopefully I said it right that time. And so I might not always see your questions if you type them, which means they might have to be repeated until you know that I saw them. But feel free to type questions or raise your hand and I'll turn the mic over to you. A couple of questions came to me. If you see me taking notes, by the way, when you're speaking, I don't like to interrupt, but I write down things so that I can remember to go back to them. One of the things that you mentioned that I would love just to look at a little deeper, you talked about how at first, prior to your brother's death, was his name Daniel? Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm remembering correctly. There's also a song about Daniel, now I have you associated with that song. Do you know the song I'm talking about?
I know. It makes me cry.
Yeah. So before Daniel's death, you talked about you were a little bit into magical thinking. Mm-hmm. And then after Daniel's death, that kind of sobered you up. For people who maybe don't really know the difference within themselves yet between magical thinking and maybe being sobered up, can you kind of just describe those two experiences?
Sure. Magical thinking in this case for me, I actually never used that word before, magical thinking. I feel like a lot of us, and I was included, become interested in spirituality in order to be able to be saved from our life as it is. And so there's this imagination that we're going to be saved from the context of our lives, like the difficulties, even our emotional worlds, the conflicts we may have within ourselves, the way we hold ourselves, and also that our lives may end up looking differently if we win the jackpot, you know, the enlightenment jackpot. And while there's some of that is really true, that when the falls, the sense of feeling separate from life falls away, as it falls away, there is a lot of conflict that also falls away. It's the resistance to life being as it is falls away. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's all going to be working out the way that we would like it to. It's not like our fantasies all about things will all come true, that we'll have the perfect relationship or job, or that money will come more easily, or that health will be perfect. So there are a lot of unconscious motivations that can run a person in that leads to wanting to be all our imaginations of what being a spiritually realized human being would look like. Okay? So I had a lot of that. And I had staked a lot of hope. And not probably any different than a lot of people, even the people I work with, it's sweet. It's kind of a grinding down actually of our fantasies, in order to be able to reveal what's really true, what's really here, and what's really here is magical all on its own. It is stunningly beautiful in its simplicity, but it isn't necessarily going to save you from this moment. Nothing's going to be saving you from your life and from this moment, or definitely not from your death. So there are a lot of things that imaginations that we have about spirituality, and those get to be sobered up over time, and I see that as a really good thing. So when my brother died, it kind of happened all in one swoop for me, because I not only had those things, those imaginations going on, but I was also very wired to be, I was a mystical type person. I think that some people are. It's not something that you can manufacture. Meaning that I saw, I was visited by, you know, beings, and I had really amazing dreams that were very helpful to me. But it didn't help me necessarily, all of that. It was good to a point, but it was a little bit like a drug. They say that spiritual addiction is one of the hardest drugs to let go of. It's a little bit hard to let go of the bliss and of that kind of the gifts that can come to you in that way. But I don't necessarily think that those things in themselves are bad, but the thing for me and for a lot of people, I think, is that they can take you away from reality, from this moment.
So they can become another distraction.
They can become another distraction. So when my brother died, I saw that I was very close to my brother, and I saw that I wasn't protected from a tragedy. I was kind of naive in my imagination that, I don't know, it's not like I had a conscious thought, I'm protected from these kind of things. But when it happened, it was such a strong kind of sobering experience that all that imagination. And I was lucky, I guess, but it was pretty radical. Just fell away, like, immediately. And for, 2-3 years, I didn't have any, spiritually mystical type experiences. And I was actually grateful. Now things have come back around, and we can talk about that later. But, because I think that everything works in balance. But it wasn't balanced at that point.
I want to ask you a little bit about intuition, because what I hear in this that you haven't spoken about is that an intuition kicked in or something like that, and you began to really listen to something different. I don't know if that's true or not. Do you feel like that's true at all?
You mean like later?
When you went from the because if you were in, at the time when you were, you know, completely in the magical thinking, as you call it, then at some point something had to have kicked in, some kind of intuition or something to show you that it was time to leave that behind now, that it was time to transition.
It happened within 24 hours of my brother's death.
Yeah.
And it was an intuition. I would say I've been led by intuition most of my life.
Okay.
Including the magical thinking. It had its place in time. I don't want to knock anything about that. But no, this was more like I got my head chopped off. Yeah. And I couldn't even contemplate magical thinking. It wasn't even in the cards.
So just a drastic change in turn.
Drastic. It was like the trauma sobered me up, you know, in a 360.
Yeah.
360. Yeah.
All right. So tell me then about the intuition that's always led you. How do you recognize or know that intuition?
Well, that's something that I think it's kind of like sharpening your own antenna, like, you know, learning how to tune in to the frequency of truth. And we get more and more concise with it over time, and we have to put into practice. So for instance, like if you get a sense that you should be turning left instead of turning right, you know, at the stop sign, you know, really strong sense, and you don't follow it, say, you might have, life might show you, this is why you were supposed to follow it. So, and if you do follow it, there might be a sense of inner alignment that occurs. So whether you choose to follow intuition or not, either way you're learning. You're learning the hard way when you don't.
Right.
And you learn and then the other way is more like you start to feel like you're in the flow and you are, you're actually, even though it doesn't necessarily mean that the outcome is going to be X, Y, you know, like if I follow this, I'm going to get that.
Right.
That's adding magical thinking into intuition. But if you follow it for the sake of following truth, because that's what you are. You are that. And as the gap closes between yourself and the knowing of which way to move in life, the more that you feel in inner alignment within yourself.
Okay, so I'd like to just kind of repeat what you said, hopefully correctly. If not, you can correct me. But I love to repeat things that I think are important because, you know, sometimes things get said so quickly. I like to highlight. So this is my highlighter. But what you said was that, you know, you're listening just for the sake of listening because you know that's you, right?
Yes.
That's you. So instead of listening to the mind or the ego or that crazy thinking, that chitter chatter of the false self, you're just choosing to start listening to the intuition because that's you and you want to listen to yourself.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then it's like the wind. You don't feel any, you know, you're just part of nature. It's just one, you're one with the movement of life. And life is kind even in its, when it kind of, you know, you have a bit of a karmic reaction to not listening. You know, when something is not as easeful or it's more difficult. Because you're not listening. You're in a relationship and you have the sense you need to leave and you don't listen and you don't listen and you don't listen and you become more and more miserable.
Right.
So that is life teaching us, you know, you still have another chance to listen. We always have another chance.
You still have another chance to listen. I love that. Okay, I don't know if there are any stories that will come to mind, but sometimes I like stories because they're like illustrations in the book. So is there any story that comes to mind for you about intuition, either when you didn't listen and learned or when you did listen and really saw how well that worked out, just kind of as an illustration?
Well, I'm not probably different than a lot of people. I mean, when I brought up the example of relationship, that's one of mine. And I feel like for many reasons we can be staying in relationship longer than maybe what's healthy for us, right? And sometimes it might be kids, sometimes it might be finances, it might be all kinds of reasons. But I know that when I, even though it's not necessarily an easy thing to listen to the voice of truth, that's what intuition is the voice of truth. As soon as you do it, you know, and that's the other thing, like you said earlier, and we're reiterating, if you don't listen to it in order to be able to get this magical thinking outcome, if I listen to it, then my life's going to be great and I'll get that perfect whatever. It's not like that. It's more because that's what we are. We are that listening, you know. And so if when we get into the flow of listening, then we feel an inner alignment. I'll just repeat that. And so it eases and buffers, even though you might have to go through the withdrawals of the ending of something, a relationship, whatever, or a job.
And be willing to walk away from what made you feel safe.
Right. What made you feel safe? Whatever imagination we have that we're better off not listening to ourselves and staying in it for whatever reason. And so I got lessons from that. I got lessons from staying too long. I got lessons from returning, you know, back again. And none of it was bad. It wasn't like the person was bad and I was in the wrong. It was more like learning how to really use the muscle of listening, you know, and gaining trust over time that this is really what one is meant to do, is listen to that degree and entering into the unknown with it, because really it propels us into the unknown. Like, I don't know where I'm going to be or where I'm going to go by listening to this. All I know is that I've got to follow that. And then we get to be, as the Buddha says, you know, be a light unto yourself. You know, so we get to listen, and the more that we listen, the more that we can become the light of the listening.
Now, do you still at this time after, you know, I think you said it's been 14 years since Daniel's death, and so 14 years of deepening, do you still sometimes resist listening to the intuition?
I don't really think so. I don't really think so. And I can't say that it wouldn't ever happen, but because, you know, that would be naive. But I think for the most part, I've become really adept at listening.
Yeah, and it sounds like trusting too.
Because
isn't it fear that would keep you from listening probably again? So, because you have to go into that unknown and...
Right. And the unknown has become my home.
Right.
And doesn't mean that there aren't always opportunities for learning, because I think as long as we're breathing and we're living and walking this earth, we're given opportunities to grow and learn and refine. So it doesn't mean it's always easy, you know, and I just have to say that included in that, there are times when I don't know. And so that is part of it as well, is learning how to become comfortable with not knowing what the next thing is or the next, you know, movement is supposed to be.
Right.
And learning to rest in that unknown.
Yeah.
Until it's again.
Yeah, that's what I often tell people, is that intuition doesn't really come with a 5-year plan. You're going to do this and then this and then this. So you may be guided to take a step, but then you have to take that step without necessarily knowing what the next step is going to be or what's going to come. So
That's it. It's in the moment kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you're doing it for its own sake,
right,
not for the 5-year plan.
All right, well, let's kind of switch gears for a moment, but never completely. But you mentioned that you have children. And one thing that, you know, lots of the people that I interview don't have children. You know, that seems to be very, very common. So whenever I interview that someone that has children, that people who are listening want to know, how does this work with children? You know, like, do your children ever become rebellious, get into trouble, and how do you deal with that if that happens? So why don't you just talk a little bit about your experience? First, tell us who your children are, what their ages are, and then talk about your experience as a parent.
Okay. I have two children, and my son Arian is 18, and he's mostly on his own. And my daughter Gaia, she's 16, and she's still with me, and partially with her dad as well. And they're both very independent and pretty whole. You know, they have their own lessons to go through in life. But I think it's really helpful to have parents who are not necessarily still seeking and not necessarily, but feel connected, feel self-connected, let's put it that way. Seeking, I don't see any of that as bad, but feel self-connected, because then they have that reflection of self-connection. So I don't know. I don't look really at my kids in the way of like, oh, they need to go on a spiritual journey and there's something that they're going to, you know. For me, it's like they're already whole, and so are you, and so is everyone I meet, actually, already whole. And then it just gets to be revealed what areas are still needing to be worked on in terms of the soul. And so I have really deep faith and trust in the development and evolution of individuals. And I see them as my children, but I also see them as individuals. And so, they, you know, my journey, I really feel that I was, from a young age, I've felt this way, that I was meant to have a boy and a girl. I was meant to have children. I was meant to experience being a mom. And so this awakening, the realization or whatever you want to call, was included in that, and used it as in order to grow, in order to, let go even, because it's really tough being a mom and maybe a father too, anyone who's really bonded to their child, to separate and to really let them individuate, but also to let go of the need to control in order to keep them safe. Because it's one thing to be able to say, okay, I'm beyond the need. I'm comfortable with death. This body is great, but I'm not attached, whatever. Whatever the realization might be, because all those could be really true. But it's really different when you have a child, because that kind of attachment can be projected onto the child. And even though one may feel free inside, it's really evident where you're still not free when you're a parent.
That's a beautiful point. Again, I'm bringing out my highlighter that, we may tell ourselves how free we are and all of that, but if we find ourselves really fearing for my children's safety, she's not home yet, was she in a car wreck, how come she's not texting, that's really an indication of how I still truly feel about myself.
Yeah, so clearly. And it's amazing how many people don't get that, don't really see that. And some people who don't have children, they may do that with their spouse or someone else in their lives. And so it's a really good way to, a good place to look and see, okay, so maybe the attachment to body seems to be kind of gone. Not that you don't necessarily care about your body, but maybe, that kind of sticky, instinctual drive of fear running the show, but then look around and see how do you hold yourself in with others, how close to you.
Yeah, good point. Again, I just want to remind everyone, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask questions. Of course, right this second, we're on the subject of children, and sometimes you guys seem to have questions on the subject of children. So if you have questions, please ask them. Put up your hand or type them on the board. I'd be very, very happy to pass those questions on. I think what I would like to ask while we are waiting for that, one word has got mentioned twice in this interview, and that's the word death. I should have made a note. You made a very interesting, you said something when we were talking about moving from magical thinking to sober. You said something about, that doesn't mean that death isn't going to happen or something like that. So can you talk a little bit about your feelings or insights around death? What is death? Do you think about death?
Yeah. Especially since my brother died, I feel like that his death was a gift to me, even though it was a very difficult gift.
Right, not a gift you would have chosen consciously.
Exactly, yeah. And that is the, but I really feel like there's part of me that's already in the beyond and one part that's in life. So I have one foot in the beyond and one foot in here in life. It's kind of like very similar to the emptiness and form, you know? And so in that sense, I don't mean death in terms of the, you know, there's a lot, there are many, all the way from the relative level of death where we really miss the person and we go through the grieving process and the very human experience of experiencing death is very valid, and I don't think we should be jumping through and bypassing any experience. But then there's a spectrum of all the way on, reaching into the absolute level of the beyond, which is beyond death actually, into the place of the unborn nature of our being. So I feel like I could speak about any of those aspects because I've had good experience now with both. So even though I did go through over time a very real human experience of grieving my brother. And not just my brother, but my dad died 9 months after my brother. And the ending of our relationship, the kid's father and I separated at that time. So like really getting in touch with the very human experience of grief, it was very valuable, and it is valuable, I find. And I think that it's kind of like a movement that if you give yourself over to anything that you're experiencing, that you can actually come out the other side. And, you know, so resisting doesn't work.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing to say, because sometimes people on these non-dual types of paths, because the teaching is so clear that you are the unborn, I think sometimes when people go through an experience of someone close to them dying, there's some kind of a guilt about mourning, like they're supposed to know that there isn't really a death there and therefore they shouldn't mourn, and maybe they don't allow themselves to really have that experience of mourning.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about, and I think that is just a misunderstanding of teachings, and I think it shortchanges our experience, because I think that God is in everything. You know, God is not only the absolute nature of being, but it's also in the nitty gritty of every experience. So you can discover the truth of true nature. You can discover true nature within any experience if you let yourself fully experience it.
I love that. You can experience the true nature within any experience if you let yourself experience it. Beautiful.
Yeah.
You go ahead.
Oh, anyway, so I don't really know where else to go with it in terms of death. So, yes, I feel like I got a very good taste of the human. Did I fade out for a second?
No, I've had you the whole time.
Of the human aspect of death, which really has brought out empathy and compassion. So it's one of the things that, like, and when we fully experience something, you know, a difficulty in our lives, a health challenge, a breakup of a relationship, a death, job loss, financial difficulties, whatever it is, if we really come out the other side, not like, you know, it's all fixed, but that we really come out the other side with understanding the feeling self-connected within it.
Yeah.
We're not lost in it. Then it's like we get cracked open a little more to life, and we become actually more available to life and to others. We don't feel so separate from someone else anywhere in the world who may be having a challenge.
Well, you know, that's interesting you should say that. My daughter is the same age as your son, and she went to college in August. And after I dropped her off, when I came back, when I was driving home, crying just started, just real hard crying. And even a couple times I even just, you know, just kind of screamed to get the emotion out. But what was amazing in the experience was I felt so connected to every mother who had ever let go of a child before. It was just like this incredible universal connection because it was an experience that I had never had before. And now I was experiencing it so deeply. I just felt very, very connected to every woman and probably man too, but I felt it at the level of mother letting go. And then I was done, you know, like now she's away and, you know, we communicate maybe every couple of weeks and you were talking about, you know, the trust and, you know, the trust is there. I trust her and it's just, and now I'm going on with my life and she's going on with hers and it's really quite wonderful. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah. You really let yourself experience it and it releases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. There was something else that you said a moment ago. Let me see if I can bring it back to my mind that I wanted to get into. Well, let me just read a little bit of what people are writing on the board. There is a question on the board. Okay, here's the question. Let's go with this question. This is from Lynn. Is there any contact with your brother or father from the other side?
No, I don't discount contact and I've actually kind of returned back. Well, I've returned. It's returned back to be included again, my mystical kind of self. You know, I took a nice hiatus. Because life really wanted to help sober me up, so I didn't like go away and just stay present and learn how to stay present to experience, right? But now it's like I've had a variety of different mystical experiences, but it's more like they come in order. They're really almost like really importantly and pre-planned, you know. But in terms of my brother, Lynn, when my brother died, for about 3 weeks, I traveled with him in the evenings, with him through the bardos, and it was just like a spontaneous thing during the night while I slept, or while the kids were sleeping. We shared a family bed because it's just the kids and I, and they were very little. So while they were sleeping, I would wake up often, and I would just spontaneously go into this place of following my brother, the energy of him as he traveled through these different bardos. Although I didn't experience the bardos, I felt them energetically. And it wasn't planned. It was just like this. I couldn't have not done it. Let's put it that way. Just like the sobering up wasn't planned. That just happened. And so I remember the moment when my brother disappeared into the beyond. It was almost like this comet that was going through the sky, and little by little it was losing its tail. And it was losing its, you know, its, the energy of what propelled it. And eventually my brother Daniel disappeared into the beyond, and I disappeared with him briefly. And that's why I think that taste of the beyond became such a part of myself. It was like the gift of Daniel's that, you know, I got to experience where he went. So I don't think that my brother stayed anywhere in a place where he was still left over enough to come and visit me and, you know, pay visits. It was like he really went into the beyond. I don't know if that beyond eventually reconstitutes itself and, you know, gets reborn, but it was done at that point. It was done for a while.
So in effect, you know, I think that sometimes when people imagine life after death and even eternal life, they imagine a particular person somehow continuing to exist.
Yeah.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, you're really saying that the person of Daniel doesn't really exist anymore. The life of Daniel still exists, but the person completed it ended.
It ended.
Yeah.
The traces of what constituted the sense of self that he was disappeared.
Yeah.
It disintegrated. So no, he doesn't visit me, but I feel like I am him, and you know, like it's not like I became Daniel, but like I feel like the unity consciousness really gave me a sense that it's all of that. He's not gone, but he's also not here as an individual.
Well, and what a beautiful thing to be able to experience that, because you know, for some people to hear that someone you love so close, like a brother or a child, that at some point they really don't exist anymore, even though there's eternal life, this doesn't exist anymore. That can be maybe a frightening thought, but you experience the beauty of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look forward to not look forward like I want it to happen now. It gave me a lot of trust in not existing.
Yes.
Like that's where we're all headed. And in terms of my dad, I have not felt him. It's really interesting. There was a moment a couple weeks ago or maybe a month ago where I briefly felt him. It was interesting. I was like, oh, there you are. But when he died, I was with my dad when he died. And when he died, as he had these beautiful sky blue eyes, and his eyes were wide open as he died. And the room was so full of intense energy. It was alive, very alive with the beyond, because he died 9 months after my brother. So I was pretty familiar with the beyond, but I was still, it was like, you know, getting even more familiar. And I told my dad, it was just spontaneously came out when he passed on over. I said, I'll see you again. And I was like, wow, where did that come from?
Yeah.
So, but, I don't necessarily think this is necessarily the case for everyone that people don't linger, that they don't, come and visit. That's just not my experience with these two beings.
Yeah, I think that maybe you're right. I think there must be more than one possibility.
Sure.
Yeah.
In fact, there was this one woman that a client that I have whose brother died, and we were talking about it, and I really felt him. Mm-hmm. I really felt him, you know, that he actually is still lingering around out of love for his mother and sister, and out of love.
Yes.
Because they kind of need it still.
Very nice. I'm going to check and see if there's any more questions. I'm not seeing any other questions. Let's see. Okay, here we go. Maybe this is a question. From the teaching in the last hour, was wondering if she has any advice of how we can best prepare for awakening. So there we go. Do you have any advice how one can best prepare for awakening?
Well, it's a beautiful question. Yeah, because it shows sincerity, you know, and strong desire. And I think that when we have sincerity and strong desires, we're having a love affair with the divine. And I think the love affair is what helps prepare. Because it's like planting a field. It's like, you know, you're making the earth really, really fertile. And you're getting ready for these nice seeds to be planted, you know, so they can sprout. So I think our love and sincerity is what helps prepare.
There we go.
Yeah. And openness. I think the more we open and learn to open to life rather than close down, we can already be doing that. You don't have to wait for awakening in order to learn how to be a yes to life. You know, to become more of an allowance. It's like laying the groundwork is so important. It really helps when realization comes, because that work has to happen no matter what. So you might as well start now learning how to open up and let go and really notice where you are, where one is resisting. All of that is like, it's preparation, but it also is awakening. Awakening is a verb. It's not necessarily just a moment in time. So you're already, this person who asked, already in the process of awakening just by having that desire. And I'm not just saying that. I'm not making that up. That's really my...
Well, and it's wonderful that you should bring that up, because, you know, there are certain things that you could say, in the community, you know, you'll hear two different teachings that at least appear at the surface level to contradict one another. Maybe if you look at them deeper, they don't, but they appear. And then, of course, you then have the students who kind of take two sides, if you will. And so one side is the side of, you know, it's really helpful to increase your desire for God or increase your desire for self-realization or increase your desire for awakening, because the more intense that desire, the more helpful. And then you have the other side, you know, don't desire. To desire is to say you don't have it. To desire is to say you are not it, that you're lacking and, you know, don't desire. So, how do those words sound to you, and what feels right for you?
Well, first of all, I was just thinking how brilliant you are. I love your questions. You have great thoughts. Well, I feel like it's individual, and that each person, rather than a should, you know, and rather than thinking that some teacher has the ultimate truth and ultimate knowledge, you know, to follow one's own, again, intuition as to what is needed. And sometimes one may be needed more than another. Sometimes it's really about letting things go and just learning to be and not wanting, you know, to just get quiet and to pull in and to let the outward momentum of wanting, you know, subside. And learn to listen to the stillness inside that doesn't want, that is complete upon itself already. And then there are other times where it's like a fire and you couldn't stop it if you wanted to. You know, it's like Rumi, his love for Shams. Yes. You know, he was all about desire and longing, right? And really fanned it and fueled it, you know, that longing. And there's no shoulds, the way I see it. It's really individual. And I think it's like what Nisargadatta talks about, earnestness. Mm-hmm. Earnestness is key, he says. And whether it's becoming quiet because it's coming from an earnest place, this intuition that's what you're supposed to do is stop the grasping, the outer grasping, you know, for something. Then follow that. And then other times this, you know, it might be really a big longing, and follow that. And that's, again, sharpening, you know, using that antenna, learning how to follow and become your own, you know, sadguru, your own the light upon yourself.
Well, and in fact, as you were speaking, I saw how the two sides are actually one, at least, you know, as my mind was listening and interpreting for me. What I heard is that, you know, sometimes the longing leads one to then, for example, sit and be.
Yeah.
Right? Because if I wasn't longing for awakening, I'd be out in the world chasing whatever. The reason I'm sitting and being is because of the longing. So, you know, they both can lead to the same end, if you will.
Absolutely. You know, there's a time and place for either. There's even a time and place for doldrums, you know, for the doldrums of not, like, you know, not knowing, there's no energy for anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, of just being feeling adrift. So it's like, if we're not resisting the experience of whatever it is, whatever that intuition is leading us, if we can really listen and follow, then we're not going to be guided in the wrong way.
Yeah, so we're back to kind of where we started, which is learning to listen to that intuition. And as you said, which actually I said in the first hour, so they're hearing this a lot tonight. You said that if you know, you listen to it when it comes, you listen to it, right? And that sharpens it. And I had said that just in the hour before you. So the people that are in the room are really getting that as a lesson tonight. That when it shows up and it says go left instead of right, go left.
Yeah,
and see where it takes you.
See where it takes you.
Yeah.
You don't need to question everything.
No. Okay, we have another question. This is actually a Lynn, but it's a different Lynn. And by the way, the question about any advice for how best to prepare, just so you know, was from Karen. Now we have a different Lynn. We actually have three Lynns in the room, and they all spell their name differently. So this Lynn is asking, where are we resisting? Now, that may be just a question she's asking herself, you know, where are we resisting? But I think I'm going to pass that question on to you, since you work with people just kind of as generalizations. Do you see patterns of where we tend to resist that it might be helpful to be aware of?
You can feel resistance in the body. Okay? So you know, it's a combination of mind, but then it eventually plays itself out in the body. And it's a tightening, usually a tightening. We have a no. It usually comes out with a no, an inner no, right? And resistance in itself is not bad, and we can actually learn to relax and allow resistance, you know? Because it can teach us. Everything that we're experiencing and feeling is actually a teacher, including resistance. So if resistance is going on inside, just feel and touch in where that's happening, where that's occurring, and see if you can tell yourself the truth about, A, that it's happening, and see if you can just kind of stop and relax into it. Just tell yourself the truth. It's happening. Here it is. And allow it. Allow it to be there first. And then as you allow it to be there, start to listen and hear what it has to say to you. There's a message there. And usually it has to do with some kind of fear, you know, letting go. If I let go, and usually there's some kind of little story. You know, if I let go, then I'll lose control. If I let go, that means that person will walk all over me. You know, if I let go, then my kids won't be safe. You know, whatever it is, whatever the story is. And see if you can just relax into the story and tell yourself the truth about the story. Oh, there's this belief that if I let go, then I'm not going to be in control anymore. Is that true? Is that really true? And does that really serve me to continue holding it in that way? Is it possible that I can, that things can still be what they are without me holding it that way? I may still prefer not to be walked all over, right, for instance. But if you let go of the resistance to it, then more innate intelligence can surface and arise and really know how to respond in the moment and to the situation much more intelligently than out of fear and shutting down. I don't know, I just gave a little description of what to do, but yeah.
No, I think it's helpful to give that little description for what to do. Anybody, there are some people who have found the feel of these things. And so as you're speaking, they know. They've already found that feel, and they're doing that. There are other people who still don't feel quite like they found it, and they're trying to find the groove of, for example, how to allow resistance. It's always helpful to hear somebody describe it again. In fact, you never know which description, whose description is going to finally, so it's beautiful. Thank you very much for doing that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wanted to go back to, yeah, and Lynn's saying that was wonderful, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome, Lynn.
One thing I wanted to go back to, in fact, you mentioned we would come back to it, so we'll do that mm-hmm. now. You had talked about you had this really mystical phase, which was appropriate, but also there was some magical thinking there, and then Daniel. And then you said that some of this mysticism has kind of come back in a more balanced way. Do you want to talk about that, what you're experiencing now?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's not like I have daily mystical experiences where I go up and out, or I have visitations by saints and such that I used to have. I'm much more here and much more in tune, actually, with nature's rhythms. And that's kind of how I wanted it anyway. I feel more balanced that way, to be, you know, to know myself as one with nature, because we are nature.
Yes.
But I've just had a few visions, and I don't really necessarily feel like going into them too much. I actually have two YouTubes out right now on my YouTube station, Susanna Marie, where I actually talk about it in depth, about these visions I've had. And one of them is about the spiritual evolution of humanity that came in last fall and really, really took me for about an hour and a half. Very visual, very experiential, where I went through, where I got to see. And, you know, this is my, what was shown to me doesn't mean it's everybody's paradigm. I'm not saying this is everybody's truth, because that, I don't feel like that would be fair. This is just what was revealed to me of the lifetime journey, lifetimes of journeys that we are going through in a chemical fire, refining in order to become all of us Buddhas. And so I was shown in detail about that. And so, and I didn't know I would be speaking about it until about a month or so ago. It came in to actually talk about. And so I did a little video thing on it, and I go, oh, there goes my non-duality coming in.
Yeah, now I'm exposed.
Not that I was really identifying in any way. I never have put myself in a box.
That's good. That's good.
But I just have to be true to myself. And this is just what revealed itself. And then I had another vision where I was shown that actually that I thought what was revealed was possibly that I could die in my 50th year. And I turned 51, so it's over. I'm not going to die. But I did have a type of death that happened in the spring, where a big sense of self fell away that was tied into the body and was tied into survival around what we were talking about earlier about my kids and such. What was still kind of being held on that I wasn't even totally aware of. And it fell away, and I have to say there's been a lot more joy, kind of like it shook some kind of fixated point of view or some position of still feeling the need for survival. Survival really fell away. And so there's been a lot more freedom here since then, but also grounded freedom. So that's how my mystical kind of life is revealing itself right now, is more through, and it's not happening all the time. I'm not saying it's not, it just happens when it's kind of like, almost like predetermined, you know, because time is not fixed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So first of all, I just want to repeat that anybody who's really interested can go to YouTube and search for, now the way that it's spelled is the way we pronounce Susanna Marie. You know, so if you type it in, S-U-S-A-N-N-E, space, right. Marie, M-A-R-I-E, and you'll be able to find these videos and watch them. I'm curious, I'm wondering if you can share a little bit more about the second thing you just talked about, how this need for survival, you said fell away. Was that just a falling away, or was there something you went through in more of a letting go process? What did that look like?
Well, I had, over the spring, from like January all the way through even June, I had a big health crisis. And I ended up in the emergency room twice. And my home, that's why I'm house-sitting this home that I'm in right now in New Mexico, my home made me sick, some kind of environmental illness of some kind, or I'm not really sure yet, but It was really dramatic, and I felt really ill, and I as a result I couldn't live there, and I couldn't have my daughter there anymore either. So she was with her father, and so I felt this lack of being able to control my life, resurfaced. I had that already when my brother died, and my father and the kid's father left me. There was a huge letting go around the ability to control. But this was like another level. This had to do with my body. This had to do with my health. And I had learned enough over time to not resist, to not turn away from experience, right? So I really trained myself to look at this stuff and to turn towards rather than away uncomfortable feelings. And so I think it was May or something, I just felt the unresolvableness of the situation, and I just I realized how it's still holding on, kind of physically holding on to the idea that I could still in some way resolve this situation with my body, with my home, with my daughter not having a home. And I could see how much I felt it physically. Oh my God, this contraction is so tight. And there was this moment of surrender that there was nothing I could do. And it wasn't like I was doing this in order to get a ride somewhere. It was just a real, in the moment kind of process. So I realized there's nothing I can do here. It's really unresolvable, you know, kind of like a Cohen, you know? Yes. And it fell out. The bottom dropped out of it. And I went from, you know, feeling like, well, I don't know how to be with this, you know, just tell myself the truth, like, you know, just land with your, you know, ass on the ground,
yeah,
and realize there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do, you know. It's not magical thinking or nothing is going to make this go away, or more problem solving is not going to make this go away. And so as soon as I gave up, and it happens that way in so many different times of our lives, you know, that we give up. And there's some kind of gift there. And so there was this big giving up, and it really had to do with instinctual fear of the body, survival of the body, let go. And I didn't know that's what was going to happen. It wasn't premeditated. It was all just this organic process. And what occurred was about, strangely, because I'm wired in this strange way, about 6 weeks of feeling, I just had this, like, so much personal will fell away, because personal will marries itself to the body. It fuses in with the body from a very young age. The sense of me, it marries the body, the flesh. And it thinks it's what is doing the walking. It's what's doing the talking. It's what's doing the drinking, the water, and the driving. But it's never been true. Innate intelligence has been doing this. Body intelligence even. Not you, because you don't exist. So whatever you think you are, it gets to unravel over time in all areas of ourselves, our minds, our hearts, and then this is the, you know, what Adyashanti talks about of the gut. This was the falling away of the controller. You know, I had my own experience of it. But what came out of it is that a great innate intelligence of the body emerged, in that we are really sensing beings. We're really sensing beings, and sensing takes over, not the sense of you. Even if you think that you've had a very deep and penetrating awakening, it can really still hide out in the body. And so that's another place for identity to let go. And it's probably the hardest place for it to let go too, because existential fear keeps it in place. The instinctual drive keeps it in place. Mm. So that fell away, and that's what my premonition vision told me, that I was going to be dying in my 50th year.
Yeah.
And that's what ended up happening. I didn't actually die, even though I went to the emergency room twice. Really, it was the sense of self being fused with the body that died.
Beautiful. Yeah, you reminded me as you were speaking about Jesus when he came out of the Garden of Gethsemane. I don't know if you know the story. It's told a little differently in the Gospels, each of the Gospels, but in the book of Mark, Jesus had to go into the garden three times. He wasn't able to really just let go all at once. And so he would go in and then he would come out and realize that the letting go wasn't complete. And he would go back into the garden three times. But when he came out the first time and realized the letting go was not complete, what he said was, the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. And he was referring to, I believe, exactly what you're speaking about. That attachment of the me to the body is what he was having so much trouble letting go of. And,
Oh, yeah. I'm getting the goosebumps. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so wonderful. Cool. And I think it's a wonderful story for people to see that Jesus, you know, people have Jesus, of course, on a pedestal. Many people do, as a master. So to see that Jesus had to go in three times, you know, that, and then you, like you said, this was for you, this was many months sort of looking at it and relaxing into it. So it's helpful for people to know that sometimes you just need to continually relax into until something completes itself.
Yes. And it's also divinely timed.
Yeah.
It's not before its time, because, you know, the release of it was so, created so many byproducts that, like, for instance, I didn't know for a while if I could remember how to drive or how to drink water because it wasn't me anymore reaching for the glass.
I understand.
Like, how is the glass going to come to my mouth?
Yeah, I understand that. I have not had this permanent experience of the sense of self dying, but I have had temporary experiences that last, you know, for periods of time, but then it comes back. But the last temporary experience was within the last month, and it was around an hour or so. And I remember those fears coming up that I wouldn't be able to like work out, that I would trip all over my feet or that I wouldn't be able to do anything. And I remember just, again, I was just relaxing, realizing this was just the mind's fear and doing my best to not buy into those fears, kind of moving back from them and watching them. But those were exactly the fears that without the mind in control, how would the practical things happen?
I know.
So talk about the experience of the practical things happening without the sense of self.
Well, first of all, when it what happened, I after about I was on a personal retreat when it happened, and then I had to get into the car. I don't think I was the safest driver, and I made it to where I was going. I mean, I felt like I had taken 10 hits of LSD, and I don't do drugs.
Yeah.
But more than that, it was such a strange experience. Like, who's driving this? I wasn't even questioning it. It was just such a strange experience to not be a driver. Hmm. Driving was happening.
Yeah.
And so then I got to where I was going, and I was going to be there for 5 days. I was kind of in teaching mode, actually, at that time. And I still could teach, luckily. But I kind of, like, after that, I'd hung out with a friend of mine who luckily understood a lot of what was going on. And I said, just don't let my mother think that I'm crazy. I had to, like, give somebody a heads up.
Yeah, I understand.
Because, you know, I didn't know where it was going. I was in such a different place. It wasn't me anymore. It was like, my vision had told me that something so radical was going to happen that I wouldn't recognize myself. And so my mind just made up the idea that it was going to be death. Hmm. And it was a death because the mind could not reflect on itself in the same way anymore. It was a new operating system was occurring. And I already had that kind of awakening in different ways, you know, and I thought it in a way, not completely naively thought it was all done. I kind of felt like something else was coming, but I couldn't have imagined what was coming. You can't pre-imagine.
Right.
So over time, it took about 6 weeks. I kept it pretty close to my heart. I didn't share it with people too much because it's hard to explain that kind of thing, you know? But, I think that just like the body, the switchover became complete, and that it fully realized that it was fully operational. There was nothing that was needed. And that what has always been running the show was just in the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's again, when I have the temporary experiences of it, the body is still moving, talking is still happening, but but the sense of doer is completely gone. In fact, the way I describe it is that it's a mysterious force has moved the body. But as I've mentioned, in my case, at least to this point, that has never stuck. But
well, that's really cool that you're getting these little tastes that you can get used to it, like a bridge.
Yeah. And that's what I practice doing when it happens, is just relaxing into it and getting used to it. Now, during this period, when you were going through this transition or shift, did you experience any fear or any mourning? I know you talked a little bit about resistance, but or tightening, I think you said. What kinds of experiences did you have while you were going through this?
Well, I think the mind was getting on board because, you know, over time I've developed a lot of trust. Like what you said earlier, I said in the very beginning, you said you mostly follow your intuitions now and trust them. So that muscle has really been put in place. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful when this kind of thing happens, you know, to fully trust. So because it didn't really look like what I had heard. Actually, I haven't heard that much about the no-self state. This is really like the no-self state. You know, it's like people refer to it, and I even used to refer to it, you know, kind of like the non-dual, I think the non-dual awakening. It one can feel like there's a center of consciousness that's liberated of the sense of me, without the no self state really having occurred. Really strange. It's kind of like in layers, and every layer feels complete upon itself. It's not like that's a lie, but the center of consciousness, it can feel like it's pretty emptied out, that there's no self there. But when it really falls away, it's a very different experience. It's like I liken it to a donut that's been jelly filled, and over time it gets emptied out. But then suddenly there's this whoosh and there's no center.
Yeah.
There's really no center. And,
yeah.
There's no self-reflection. Self-reflection ends. The ability to self-reflect ends because there's no center to reflect on.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of like the donut hole. So that's what the mind had to get used to. And it had been getting used to it over time, like what you're saying, that you have these moments, you know. For me, it's been a good while. It had been a good while, maybe 3 or 4 years, where I couldn't feel a center of consciousness. But it still had a little hold. It had a hold on the body, which is fine. It's like, I feel so kind and loving and compassionate to how this moves. Like there's no, like anything wrong along the way. You know what I mean? It has an intelligence of when and how things fall away. And because it's really radical, it's so radical when it happens that if you're not prepared in some way, you could really think that you've gone crazy.
Well, yeah, I understand that from my experiences.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to hear you speak, you know, in the way that you are and relate those to my experiences, I find is very helpful. And as the experiences continue or when they return, again, I will continue to do what I've done, which is just surrendering to them. One thing that you mentioned was something about the mind getting on board.
Yeah.
And I think I can sense that because what I see during the experiences is that's what's actually surrendering is the mind. It's like at one level, the mind is having the fear, like, you know, will I be able to work out or will I just trip all over my feet? But at the other level, it's the mind that's surrendering away from its own fear. At least that's the way I witness it during the experiences.
Yeah. And the mind sees that the body actually is, there's an intelligence that's running the body and it doesn't need personal will in order to make things happen.
Well, and in fact, during my last experience, that was the sense. Now, it wasn't words. I'm going to put this into words. But the sense was that this mysterious force was asking the mind, trust me. You know?
Yeah, so we, you know, it's very kind, you know, it gives us, sometimes it's radical, you know, like I think maybe with Byron Katie, you know, it was a very radical thing of falling away. I don't know her, you know, full story of whether her mind had to get on board with it or not. But I think for most of us, there's a rhythm with some gentleness and then maybe some radical things, and then, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't peeked for a while to see if there are questions. I don't see any questions at this moment. Now, we only have 10 minutes left. So I think that one thing that's really useful to talk about while you're here is, what you do again as far as, like, you work with people. So can you talk a little bit about the service that comes through you?
Oh, I like how you put that. The service that comes through you. That's beautiful. I feel like it continues to deepen. I lead online groups. In fact, today was my last in a series because I'm going to be going to the SAN conference as this presenter in Science and Non-Duality in San Jose. And I'm driving there, and it's a long drive. And so I timed it so that my last online group just ended. And I'll pick them back up in a couple of weeks. I have a really reasonably priced as well. I have a very, generous sliding scale. I think it's based on ability to pay. In terms of doing my individual sessions with people, I call them mentoring sessions. And I work with people on Skype usually or Zoom so they can record it. And then I do my online groups, and then I also do in-person groups when I'm stable, settled, wherever that's going to be next. And so I work with people, meeting people exactly where they are. And whether that's like, you know, someone who's still planting this, you know, setting the stage for a seeker. And because to me, the truth and reality is contained in the experience that you're having right now. So I use that as an entryway, whatever experience someone's having right now, as a way to be able to help people access their self-connection, truth. So it's like a vast spectrum of people I work with, people who are already embodying awakening. And like you and I just discussed right now, there are so many stages to that even. There's so many depths of realization that exist, continual depths. Like what happens after the no-self state? I don't know. So, you know, so that's, it's just a love affair I have with the divine in terms of working with others, you know? And I actually asked for permission from my teachers, you know, permission meaning I really wanted to get the sense from them if they felt like I was ready, because I really wanted to ultimately be non-harming. Mm-hmm. And to have it come from a true place. And I sensed it was coming from a true place. I was ready to even not do it and do something completely different if that's not what life had in store for me. So there's not a lot of ambition that I have in regards to this, but it's just letting myself be moved by life. See how it all goes. There's just more living to be done. But I don't know. I just like the work I do, and I don't know if you have anything else to ask in relation to it. Yeah.
Well, why don't you? I think I posted your website before, but just while everybody's listening, why don't you tell us your website so people can look there?
Okay, it's called Transformation Through Presence.
.org, yes. Correct?
Sorry,
is it .org?
Yes, .org or .com, okay. Either one. And I have different interviews on there from Buddha at the Gas Pump and Conscious TV and now this one. And so you can kind of get a sense of my work and who I am, although it's continually developing, you know. Yeah. So feel free to contact me, anybody who wants to.
Yeah, well, you have a very, you know, a very gentle spirit, and I'm sure that some people will be very attracted to that gentleness.
Oh, thank you.
You mentioned your teachers. You said you asked your teachers if they thought that you were ready. Who do you perceive as your teachers?
Amachi and Adya Shanti.
Okay.
And then there are, I mean, I have other teachers that are just like Mother Earth, you know? And then there are some other teachers that are not in the body anymore. Neem Karoli Baba, who is Ram Dass's guru.
Okay.
You know, just people who I feel affinity for. We all have different beings that we feel affinity with, you know, because of probably resonance.
Yes.
And, but I also felt really like life was, life is the ultimate teacher. And so I don't really place these teachers too much above me, although I do feel like there are elders that exist who help us, who support us, and then we support other people in turn.
Yeah, one of the early visions that I had when I first entered the spiritual path, it was based on Plato's cave, the vision. And in the vision, we were all sitting down, looking down, thinking we were chained down, but we weren't chained down. And I was just beginning to look up. And when I looked up, I saw the stairway leading out to the light. And there was a teacher on every single step. Helping people as they got up from the cave and as they started leaving the cave. And so what I saw was that, you know, there will be teachers along this process. You don't want to become attached to a teacher or idolize a teacher, but you want to listen to a teacher who's at the right step for you. Because if you listen to that teacher really with the heart and pay attention to that teacher, that teacher's helping you up to the next step.
Exactly.
So, and
ultimately a teacher wants you to fly on your own.
Absolutely. Yeah. Any true teacher
wants
you to be on your own. Absolutely. Listening to that own inner intuition and awakening. Yeah. Well, it has been an absolute delight to talk to you. Let me check on them one more time to see if there's. No, people are saying they're enjoying the interview. I see a wow. I don't know what was said when the wow was written, but somebody said wow.
Thank you for that wow.
and we have someone saying lovely, a blessing for sure, thanks. They're all really appreciating this. Now, I will be in touch with you via email tomorrow. I don't know if you have I think we'll probably work together through PayPal. I doubt you have a mailing address right now. You sound like you're a little bit on the home free side. And I'll send you a copy of the audio. So I'll be in touch with you tomorrow. But I want to thank you very much for saying yes. I always really appreciate it when people say yes to me and yet they have no idea who I am. They have no idea where I'm coming from. They have no idea what I'm going to say, what I'm going to ask, and yet they say yes anyway. I really love that. So thank you.
And thank you too, Regina. It's been lovely getting to know you. I feel like we're so much on the same page.
Yeah, it's been lovely getting to know you too. I will be
finding a sister.
Yeah, and I'll just kind of blow you a kiss. That's your 3 hours that direction from me right now. So there you go.
Yeah, I just got it.
Yeah.
That's a fast moving one. And thank you. I want to thank your audience and everyone there for tuning in and just being open to, you know, receiving. It's a back and forth receiving is how I feel, even though I'm not aware of the people totally, you know?
Yeah.
It's a back and forth.
Yeah, well, they are definitely engaged, even though no one put their hand up. They are totally engaged and paying attention. Someone says, Regina, did you see what Larry typed? Okay, here we go. I would love to hear Susanna's take on the daily quote. Okay, this is the daily quote. We have a quote every day that we contemplate as a group. So here's today's quote. The ability to perceive differences and to discern one thing from another is one of the most valuable tools you can have. It is one of the most valuable tools you can have both for your spiritual progress and for how to live in the worldly life. Michael Langford. So the ability to perceive differences and discern one thing from another as a tool. Any comments on that?
Well, I feel like it collapses duality to be able to learn how to perceive differences and to hold them maybe with an open heart, to be able to step back further into the undifferentiated truth, you know, what holds differences, the container that holds differences. So if you can feel that, the vastness of our undifferentiated self, and also be able to tune into differences at the same time, then you're learning how to be able to live the paradigm of being able to hold both emptiness and form and know them both as the same.
So again, in the non-duality world, sometimes it happens, because of teachings, which are true teachings, that there's no differences in the self. You know, maybe there's some denial of differences. I don't know how you could deny differences. You know, like I know the difference. I always tell people I know the difference between a glass of water and a toilet. That's important to know the difference between a glass of water and a toilet, don't you think?
Well, I think if you can hold differences and know that they are both, that they are all aspects of God.
Yeah. And also you have to know the difference between the intuition we talked about and, you know, that which isn't the intuition, you know, the true self and the false self.
Exactly. So. That's really good. It sets up now I'm fading.
That's all right. We've been talking for a long time.
I know the difference of when I'm on and when I'm not.
Yeah, in harmony and out of harmony, or in alignment and out of alignment. Well, you know, I love what you talked about, the container, though. You know, focusing on the container that includes all of the differences.
Yeah, and like you said, when we look, life will teach us when we're going in the wrong direction, and then you get to learn the difference between following truth, what it feels like to follow truth, and to follow ego.
Yeah, and there's a difference right there that's very important to be able to discern. I mean, what if you couldn't tell the difference between when you were following truth and when you were following ego? You'd be quite lost.
Discernment is great, but if you don't get stuck in it, if it's not sticky with identity, and you are those differences. So that's why I brought up the container.
Yeah. Yeah. You,
yeah.
All right. Well, gosh, we could have started a whole nother discussion with that one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
everybody.
Very much. It's been wonderful having you, and I will be in touch with you tomorrow.
Sounds good.
All right.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. So that was lovely. I enjoyed it. I think what I can tell is that you all did too. I am going to be leaving the room for about 28 minutes. I have these two audios together, the seven steps and the Susanna Marie. I need to separate them and get them saved separately. So that takes a bit of time. But I will be back in about 27 minutes for the daily contemplation. Lynn, the mic is yours.